The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Uzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Chebar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Whew! That in and of itself is a difficult passage, isn't it? That is getting down in the weeds. I want to try to get above the weeds a little bit tonight, but then we're going to go back in the weeds. Hopefully, as we were reading through that, there was one phrase that caught your attention. What was it? There you go. According to the word of the Lord, okay? If you'll notice, we talked about this morning, verse 3. The message of the Lord, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. So what you have in Ezekiel is that message, that unitary one word that comes to Ezekiel. One other phrase I want you to also note. Look in verse 1. Amidst all of the dates, all of the names, and all of the geographical locations, I hope you also notice this. I saw visions of God. It's mind-blowing to begin with. I saw visions of God. Ezekiel is one of the few men or women who's ever lived who has ever seen visions of God. Now, exactly what those visions consist of and exactly what they tell us about the nature of God, I'm not going to tell you till Friday. But it's amazing as you go into the prophetic and poetic language of Ezekiel to see what those visions of God consist of. So we're going to leave all that till Friday. But to get some of the background knowledge about these visions of God, I want to point out a couple of things. Number one, if you look at verse 1, in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month. Now, exactly what does this mean? In the 30th year, there's a few different views of this, but there's one I'm convinced it must be. I am convinced, at least. This is talking about Ezekiel's age. Now, let me tell y'all why I'm convinced of this. Ezekiel, if you look a little bit later in the text, okay, go down to verse 3. The word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, okay? So Ezekiel is a priest, therefore from the tribe of Levi. If you are of the tribe of Levi, the year 30 is a very important age. If you go to Numbers chapter 4 and cross-reference that with 2 Chronicles 29, you understand 30 for the priest was when they began serving in the ark. So they would begin their temple service at the age of 30. So a priest, up until the age of 30, if he was from the tribe of Levi, would have received training and instruction. But from age 30 to age 50 was when he would have been in active service at the temple. Now, why is this important? Number one, I think within the immediate context of Ezekiel, what the book is going to show us is Ezekiel is performing his priestly duties in the context of the captivity. Now, exactly what all that consists of, it takes a lot of time to get through, and we'll talk about that on Friday, but you understand, this is the earthly stage at which a priest began service. But now think a bit further. Where else do you read of the age of 30 in the scripture? Aha, I see some head shaking. Jesus. Why was Jesus 30 years old when he began his ministry? Why 30? I'm convinced of this. It is because in the Old Testament, priests began their priestly service at age 30. Jesus then begins his priestly service at the age of 30. So that number 30 to us is somewhat arbitrary, but to an ancient Israel, an ancient Hebrew, they clearly would have understood the spiritual significance of this age. Just as the Levites began their priestly service at age 30, Jesus begins his priestly service at the age of 30, as does Ezekiel. But now continuing the text. Verse 2, on the fifth day of the month, it was in the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim. So here's what we have to do. Before on Friday, we can talk about the visions and how mind-blowing they are. If you've read through chapter 1, you'll understand Ezekiel is not baby food. It is a big old steak that you got to chew on to get down. Mark and I had lunch just a couple months ago now. We spent, I think, almost an hour just talking about chapter 1. Chapter 1 alone, you could spend a whole evening on and never get all that's in there. It's a deep, poetic book. And these visions of God are amazing as you get into them. But to understand the historical background of what's going on here, verse 2, you have to know who King Jehoiakim is. So who, or depending on what part of Kentucky you're from, King Jehoiachin, probably if you look at the phonetic of this, this is the hard CH, like Loch Ness Monster, so it's probably King Jehoiakim, just a little linguistic term for you. King Jehoiakim, or Jehoiachin, whichever way you want to say it. Who is he? Who is he? You will not understand anything in the book of Ezekiel unless you know who this guy is. You have to know who he is. Now, I've been told before, y'all know I put questions up at the beginning of all of my AM sermons. I've been told before I should pass around note cards sometimes and just see what the answers are. I would love to pass around a note card and see how many could tell me who King Jehoiakim is. This is not a condemnation on anyone here. This is just to illustrate. I think for every Bible student I've ever met, maybe with the exception of Tommy Peeler, the kings are our weakest period of all Bible history, right? We know who David is. We know who Solomon is. We get Rehoboam and Jeroboam confused at times. And then from there, it just goes downhill. I mean, you probably have heard of King Hezekiah. You've probably heard of King Josiah. You know that Manasseh is a terrible guy. But actually figuring out who Zedekiah is, trying to figure out who Jehoiakim is, trying to figure out who Jehoiachin is, whether he's the same person as Jehoiachin, all that gets really confusing. So what I want to do is I want to try to get down in the weeds a little bit and try to sift some of these out so that we can make sense of who King Jehoiakim is. Because if you know who King Jehoiakim is and what's going on in Israel during this time, the rest of the book of Ezekiel makes a lot more sense. So let's actually go back to the book of 2 Kings. Let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings chapter 24. 2 Kings 24. We're going to begin in verse 8. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king. And he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. And my guess is, if most of your translations, if not all of them, you now have a subheading that begins the next part, Jerusalem captured. I realized a few months ago, there's some preachers that make a big deal out of chapter divisions. I can't stand subheadings in Bibles. I'm coming to find out that 90% of the subheadings there just don't make sense. Take that subheading out of your Bible. This continues the reign of King Jehoiakim, all right? Just read the text with me, okay? Go to verse 9. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. And at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, gave himself up to the king of Babylon himself and his mother and his servants and his officials and his palace officials. They're all a bunch of spineless invertebrates. The king of Babylon took his prisoner in the 8th year of his reign and carried off all the treasure of the house of the Lord and all the treasure of the king's house and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold in the temple of the Lord, which Solomon, king of Israel, had made, as the Lord had foretold. He carried away all Jerusalem, and all the officials, and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and all the smiths. None remained, except the poorest people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiakim to Babylon, the king's mother, the king's wives, his officials, the chief men of the land he took into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon all the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen, strong and fit for war. And the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, Jehoiakim's uncle, king in his place, and changed his name to Zedekiah. You have to understand the immense emotional impact that this passage would carry on an ancient Israelite. This is the tragedies of tragedies. In Shakespearean language, take Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, mix them together, you still don't have 2 Kings 24. This is as bad as it gets, okay? It's going to get worse. This is as bad as an Israelite can think it would get. Notice what happens during the reign of King Jehoiakim. If you look at verse 10, I want you to pay careful attention here. At that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up to Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. Okay? We know from secular history that 2 Kings chapter 24 and verse 10 happens in 597 B.C. 597 B.C. If you're taking notes, write down a few dates. Some of these dates are going to get a bit confusing, okay? But as you corroborate the biblical text with what we know from the Babylon and even Assyrian history, Nebuchadnezzar, this date in 2 Kings 24:10, this is 597 B.C. 597 B.C. Now, in the grand scheme of Old Testament narrative, where does this fall? Let's think of our 5500s, okay? Quiz time. 2000 B.C. was Abraham. 1500 B.C. was Moses. 1000 B.C. was David. 500 B.C. was Malachi. 0 B.C. was Christ. In the grand scheme of biblical narrative, we are at about 600 B.C. We are about 100 years away from the end of Old Testament narrative, okay? We are about 1,400 years removed from Abraham. We are over 1,000 years removed from Moses and over 500 years removed from David. A long time has happened in the Israelite narratives. But as you look here at what's happening, this has to be looked at within a very precise date. Let me explain why. 597 B.C. is the date that we know that this ransacking happens. Now, if you look back at 2 Kings chapter 24, I want us to note what happens during the reign of King Jehoiakim, all right? If you look at the reign of King Jehoiakim, during this time, verse 11, Nebuchadnezzar comes up. We know a lot about Nebuchadnezzar from secular history, okay? He was the biggest bad and the strongest strong that could be of the time. He overtook the Assyrian Empire. He's going to march in and go against the Egyptians, and then he is going to take, in about 10 years, he's going to take Judah and ransack them. But then as you continue in verse 12 down through the rest of verse 17, this essentially is the ransacking of the temple. That's what this is. As you read through, especially Chronicles, okay? Let me just make one quick note, historical note. I've not taught a lot from Kings and Chronicles yet, just because I've not had a chance to. But one thing I think that has really hurt our studies of those books is we read them in conjunction with one another. Yes, historically they're telling the same events, but spiritually they are told from very, very different perspectives. As you go especially into the Chronicles, Chronicles focuses on the southern kingdom of Judah, and everything in those books is leading up to the fall of the temple. So as you go through, there is a lot of attention paid to the priests. There's a lot of attention paid to Mount Zion. There's a lot of attention paid to the kings and how they interact with the priestly service at the temple. Kings, on the other hand, tells much more of the geopolitical features of what's going on and also has much more of an emphasis on the prophets. But as you take both of these narratives and tie them together to one great narrative, here's what you notice. Everything in Kings and Chronicles is leading up to the fall of Judah. Now, there's one date of the Old Testament in our Old Testament class last year I urged y'all to remember. 586 B.C., okay? If you could know one date of the Old Testament by heart, I want you to know the 5500s, But if you had to know one date of the Old Testament by heart, it's 586 BC. What happens in 586 BC? That is when, remember, that is when Babylon comes and destroys the temple. Okay? Babylon is going to come and destroy the temple in 586 BC. So if you continue down into the narrative, you go down into chapter 25, verse 1. The ninth year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, we know with certainty. This is chapter 25, verse 1. This is January 15th, 588 BC. Okay? 25:1 is January 15th, 588 BC. Go down a bit later. Chapter 25, verse 8. In the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, that is the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. This is, again, one we know for certain, July 18th, 586 BC. Okay? So if you look again, chapter 25, verse 8, this is July 18th, 586 BC. So dates are hard for people, I know, but you got to know the dates, okay? You have to know the dates to understand the spiritual implications of what's going on here. Now, let me back up and hopefully get us all on the same page. 597 BC, 597 is when Nebuchadnezzar marches in and ransacks the temple. But it's not going to be until 586 that the temple is actually going to be destroyed. Okay? About a 10-year difference. Between 597 BC and 586 BC are many of the events of Jeremiah and most of the events of Ezekiel. That 10-year period to us is a small section of biblical history, but a lot goes on in that 10-year period. And I want to explain why here in a second. If you look back at Ezekiel chapter 1, verse 1, it's really 1 through 3, Ezekiel begins in 593. Okay? So he's about halfway in between. Nebuchadnezzar comes and ransacks in 597. Ezekiel begins in 593. But then the temple's destroyed in 586. This 10-year period is really important to understand. Let me explain why. Imagine that a home is destroyed. Okay? 597 BC, this is like a bunch of thieves coming into the house and taking all the goods. But then, after all the goods are taken, they've even taken the carpet. They've taken the doorknobs. They've taken the handles. They've taken everything. The house still stands. It really doesn't do much good. But then 10 years later, a tornado comes and wipes it out. Ezekiel begins his prophecy in 593 between the ransacking and the destruction. Now, why is that important to understand? And why is Jehoiakim important to understand to the narrative of Ezekiel? I want us to leave 2 Kings, and I actually want us to go to Jeremiah, please. Let's go to Jeremiah chapter 27. Jeremiah 27. Isaiah, our Bibles at times, just the construction of it, it confuses us at times because we think Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel were like same time buddies. Isaiah is a different time period. A little bit, not as far off as like Elijah. Jeremiah and Ezekiel are contemporaries. Ezekiel is going to be off with Jehoiakim in Babylon. Jeremiah is still going to do most of his prophesying in Judah to the kings and also to the people. But as you note in Jeremiah chapter 27, you should in your subheading, this is actually a good one, you should note in your subheading the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar should be a familiar name by now. Because remember, he's the one that came in 597 and ransacked the place. And then in 586, he's going to come in and destroy the temple. But notice what he says. Jeremiah chapter 27. Let's begin in verse 1. In the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Thus, the Lord spoke to me. Make yourself straps and yoke bars and put them on your neck. Send word to the king of Edom, the king of Moab, the king of Ammon, the kings of Tyre, and the king of Sidon by the hand of the envoys who have come to Jerusalem to Zedekiah, king of Judah. Give this charge for their masters. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel. This is what you shall say to your masters. Let me make one quick note. Do you know what that idea means in verse 4, the Lord of hosts? It's the God of armies, is what that's saying. Anytime you read the Lord of hosts, that's not saying our gracious and merciful loving Father. That is saying our strong and powerful King is coming in with his army. Verse 5. It is I, by my great power, in my outstretched arm, that I've made the earth with the men and animals that are on the earth, and I give it to whomever it seems right to me. Now I've given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and have given him also the beasts of the field to serve him. All the nations shall serve him, and his sons and his grandson, until the time of his own land comes. Then many nations and great kings shall make him their slave. What's he saying? This yoke represents the yoke that Nebuchadnezzar is going to put on all the nations around him. And historically this happens. Nebuchadnezzar marches in and he is going to take every nation in the ancient Near East. But then God says he's going to do it for a little while, but then Babylon's going to fall and someone else is going to take him. But continue on verses 8. But if any nation or kingdom will not serve this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and put its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon, I will punish that nation with the sword, with famine, and with pestilence, declares the Lord, until I have consumed it by his hand. So do not listen to your prophets, your diviners, your dreamers, your fortune tellers, or your sorcerers who are saying to you, you shall not serve the king of Babylon. For it is a lie that they are prophesying to you, with the result that you have been removed far from the land, and I will drive you out and you will perish. But any nation that will bring its neck under the yoke of the king of Babylon and serve him, I will leave it on his own land to work it and dwell there, declares the Lord. Essentially, Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and take everybody. But then as you go to verse 12, he takes the same message and tells to Zedekiah. Zedekiah, Kings and Chronicles are discordant here. Kings calls him, I believe, the uncle. Chronicles calls him the brother. Some relative. It's not a contradiction in the text, but he's a relative of Jehoiakim. This essentially monkey king is what he is. I mean, he has no real authority. He's just a puppet of the king of Babylon. This puppet is saying, yeah, Nebuchadnezzar's not going to take us. But then as you go down to verse 16, then I spoke to all the priests, the same message. And then as you go to chapter 28, you read of this man Hananiah. Hananiah is a false prophet saying, no, the nation will not fall. So understand what's happening here. This is in 597, by the way. After, remember, 597 is our first, 586 is our second. This is after Nebuchadnezzar's come in. So historically, let's understand why this is important. 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar comes in, he ransacks the place, takes everything that he wants. Jehoiakim, the weak little mollusk that he is, follows the king of Babylon and says, fine, great king, I will go with you so that I may live, rather than actually taking a stand for the great God of Israel. I will go with you. He and all of his mighty men, what an oxymoron that is, they go with him. All of the gold goes. Everything goes. But then in 586, it's destroyed. After 597, prophets arise among the people and say, God may have allowed Nebuchadnezzar to take our gold, our men, and even our king, but God will never let his temple be destroyed. That's what the false prophets are saying. There's many reasons they believe this. Think of 2 Samuel 7. God tells, through Nathan the prophet, to David, I will make an everlasting covenant with you. Think of Genesis 15. Of your nation will be no end, God says to Abraham. And even historically, they've seen this. Think back to King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 18 through 20. In 2 Kings 18 through 20, Assyria, a different nation, had arisen against the people. Hezekiah prays, and through intercessions he has with Isaiah, God is going to relent of that judgment. So here the people are thinking, yes, God may have allowed our home to have been ransacked. God may have even allowed his own temple to have allowed all that is good within it to go. But God will never let his house burn. Now you're an Israelite. That temple represents the very presence of your God. That temple represents the very covenant with Abraham. It represents the very law of Moses. It represents the kingship of David. Imagine it's destroyed. What's going to happen? All hope is lost. Nothing good's ever going to come again. Our great talisman, as the Israelites often treated it, is gone. What's going to happen? So between 597, that first ransacking, when Jehoiakim is taken in, and 586, when Jerusalem's actually destroyed, that's when Ezekiel begins his ministry. And Ezekiel is going to take his priestly ministry through 571 BC. And for about a 20-year period, is going to witness from the perspective of an Israelite in Babylon what is going on in his nation. It is as existential of a crisis as you could ever imagine. But Ezekiel is going to be there the whole way to tell them what is going to occur, how it's going to happen, what God is thinking of during this time. And is there any hope that remains? And that then is where we shall begin our study of Ezekiel. Get out your songbooks, please. So, our study on Friday night, it's going to be a more in-depth Bible study. I'm really looking forward to it. I've done things like these with young people under 18 many times. But I'm so excited for us above 18 who are actually of age to get in and actually study the Bible together for a long period of time. Ezekiel, y'all, is an amazing book. Tonight, we've done a lot of history. I hope the dates didn't lose you. You have to get the dates to understand what's going on, okay? It's kind of like whenever you teach American history, right? If you think that America and the Constitution was signed in 1886, you're going to have some problems understanding, right? You have to know some dates before you can get to the really good stuff. The same is true with Bible study. You have to know the dates before you can get to the good stuff. And likewise, knowing these dates, knowing the 593, the 597, the 571, the 586, knowing the significance of those dates are going to help us immensely as we begin. But now knowing these dates, knowing who Jehoiakim is, knowing the historical context of Ezekiel, we can jump right into chapter 1 with that great vision of God and all that it entails. And it is mind-blowing to read through Ezekiel chapter 1. I mean, Ezekiel, there's some books that build up to a climax. Ezekiel begins with a climax. And then it just gets better from there. Because as you read from his perspective what is going to go on during the time of captivity and how God is responding to his people during this time, the question is going to remain for about the first 25 chapters, is there any hope left? Is there any hope left? And then we'll find out together, does Ezekiel give any hope at all? Or is it a message of doom and gloom? We'll find out together. I hope you're excited about it. Ezekiel, as I hope you noticed, spoke the word of God. I hope that phrase has new meaning to you after this morning. It was also in the reading of Kings. I don't know if you caught it. But as we listen to the voice of God through his word, God in ages ago spoke in many ways through his prophets, but now he's spoken through his son, and that word has always been constant. It is by that word he's created, by that word he has commanded, and by that word he has given his words that we may know his will. How wonderful our God we serve, right? If you need to respond to his message call of salvation, come forward while we stand and sing.